I used to be able to name every nut that there was. And that used to drive my mother crazy because she used to say, Harlan Pepper, if you don't stop naming nuts. And the joke was, of course, that we lived in pine nut. And I think that's what put it in my head at that point. So I'd go to sleep. She'd hear me in the other room and she would just start yelling. I'd say, peanut, hazelnut, cashew nut, macadamia nut. That was the one that would send her into going crazy.
TBTL!
You know, I would like to take this straw and stick it in your ear and extract everything you've ever thought or felt or seen or even dreamed about your profession.
I gotta be honest with you, sir. The kind of work I do, I don't think it's as interesting as you think it is.
My podcast is on life support. Hey, I need new listeners.
That was a joke. Humor is the tool of the interesting.
I was skeptical. It seemed too good to be true. I'm so glad I tried it.
All right, hello, good morning, and welcome everybody to a Monday edition of TBTL, the show that just might be too beautiful to live.
It's an audiophile's nightmare.
My name is Luke Burbank. I'm your host.
Oh, hey, y'all said my name.
Checking in once again from the Burbank Springs Broadcast Center, which is perched atop Alabama Hill in Bellingham, Washington, Bay City. I mean, we are fogged in here, you guys. Were this an airplane, we couldn't take off. We'd be on a hold from the tower because of low visibility. I can barely see the neighbor's house, which is, I don't know, like 200 feet from here. They can still hear me. I mean, that's the important thing. A lot of you donate to keep the show going, and we appreciate it. Meanwhile, my neighbors, they get half of this conversation for free every day as it leaks out from the Burbank Springs Broadcast Center, crosses the yard, and hits them where they live. Is that why they built that sound wall? Anyway, you're all here voluntarily, I assume, and I hope excited about episode 3049 in a collector series where we have arrived.
Let the fun begin.
On this Monday, and there is an art story that is actually, speaking of leaking out of its container, it has left the bounds of just the art world and it's entered the larger sort of popular imagination. A guy taped a banana to a wall at Art Basel in Miami, which is this big art fair where lots of cool, new, interesting, expensive art is being sold. And
I mean, it's one banana, Michael. What could it cost? $10?
Actually, $120,000 to $150,000 to buy a banana that's taped to the wall. And it's BYOB when you buy the piece. When you install the piece at your home, you have to... It doesn't even come with the banana, because the banana spoils. So anyway, we'll talk about that. And there's just been all these developments in the story that are pretty hilarious. And it's also an artist who we've talked about on this show before. Because this is pretty much the podcast of record, I think, for art conversations. And people know that, and that's one of the reasons people turn to us. It's also one of the places that people turn to hear the longest-running Cobro of this program. Wouldn't it be weird if they tuned into a different show to hear the longest running Cobro of TBTL? He's known for his drawings of tall ships. That's where part of our art pedigree comes from. He is Andrew
Boom Boom
Walsh, and he's joining me right now from the Roosevelt neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Good morning, my friend.
This show is going to be bananas, Luke.
Uh-huh. B-A-N-A-N-A-S.
Tomorrow we should do a segment about nuts, and then I can start the show by saying, this show is going to be nutty, Luke. And then we'll just keep on booking shows in that manner.
If we have any artists out there in the listening audience, if you could quickly do an installation where you duct tape some nuts, and I do mean the kind that grow... I realize the problem with what I was about to say is I don't actually understand the mechanism by which nuts grow. Are they underground? Is it a bush? What happens? Like, I was trying to clarify that I wasn't being dirty. I meant, you know, like Harlan Pepper, I meant Brazil nuts and the like. But I honestly don't think I know exactly how. Well, like, okay, almonds. I know almonds grow. It's a tree, right? Almonds, is that a tree? Is that a shrub?
I'd like to bow out of this conversation. Like, you've really pushed me into a corner where I have to answer where almonds come from. And
I thought you'd just Google it.
That's what I'm trying to do right now. I'm stalling.
Oh, that's you. Wow, how slow is your internet? Almond. It's a species of tree native to Iran and surrounding countries, but it's widely cultivated elsewhere. So it is a tree, at least according to the very first thing that came back on my internet search. I get confused about legumes, tubers, the like, you know, things that I don't know. I could see a world in which I think, because peanuts grow in the dirt, in the soil, right?
That rings a bell. Right, I'm sorry, I'm just writing down. It's not a tuber as a possible show title.
although this digression was 100% worth it.
We are to a point now where I feel like every show title we come up with, we've already used as a show title. Like, mm-hmm. I'm almost 100% sure. We did this the other day, too. Maybe it was when we were pre-taping some hashtag mm-hmm. content this weekend. We came up with a perfect show title. I swore it was already used, but I couldn't find it online. Mm-hmm.
The guy is a nut bar. A nut bar.
Yeah. We need to do some kind of – maybe what we just do is every single show title. So today, it's not a tuba. And then we just do dot one.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
Dot two.
Yep.
And we just that's a standing, like, that's the kind of naming convention for show titles. So it's the second generation of the first time that we named the show whatever we named it, and then we're insulated.
On October 26th, the year of our Lord 2018.
Wow,
Episode number 2758, TBTL Petagogy Part 3, It's Not a Tuber. So that's a complicated... Jesus. That was when we did
really
a whole week of...
Peanut.
Andrew and Luke wrap up their series... Actually, it's Luke and Andrew. I don't put my name first. I don't know why I just swapped it around in my... as I was reading it, Luke and Andrew wrap up their series of shows about childhood pets with a look at Andrew's life on the quote unquote farm and a cat that entered Luke's life just when he needed it most. That sounds like a very special Christmas movie made for TV.
That sounds like the story of Shop Cat.
Yeah, I think so.
Probably. So that's amazing that we would have. I mean, we really at this point we're two monkeys typing on two typewriters, mm-hmm. and we. Because, like, it's not a tuber. Like, what? It's just weird that we would say enough words to each other that it would be – that two times we would have arrived at it's not a tuber.
Yeah.
That's like the – I mean, I don't want to get grandiose, but that's basically the first line of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, it is, yeah.
That's the whole seven monkeys, right? That's the idea behind that? We
I
just
think
did
so,
that
in our
universe.
I mean –
It was the best of times. It was the blurst of times.
I think that – I mean, I guess I'm a little less shocked. I think it's more that I'm a hack. Like, I love that it's not a tumor line. That's from Kindergarten Cop, I think. I would think of my friend Steve Udich, who played the sousaphone, and he used to go around telling people, it's not a tuba, because it looked like a tuba.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good spoof there.
So.
Look, people in our listening audience and in our own lives are dealing with health things and, you know. I don't want to be glib, but I will say that if I were a doctor, if I were an oncologist and someone were worried about something and we did a biopsy and it turned out to be, you know, not life-threatening and also not even something that was a tumor, it would be hard for me to not walk into the room and say, good news, it's not a tumor.
Yeah, I know. Would you do it in the voice, though?
Well, over time, that would start to creep in.
Uh-huh.
So I'd be nervous the first time because I'd be like, this is a pretty jokey way to deliver this news. Granted, it's good news.
Yeah.
But I'd start with like a sort of like, it's not a tumor. And then over time, I'd be like, it's not a tumor. And then it'd just be fully, get down. There's no time in the farmer's field. It's not a tumor. Get to the chopper. My extended Schwarzenegger.
Oh,
like,
my,
you know. And then somebody from HR would have a box with my stuff in it. And they would say, please never come back to this hospital. I would say I understand.
Also, you're not a doctor, sir. Please leave.
Yeah.
I'm surprised it went on
this long. I'm going to be totally honest with you.
Should we – this is probably bad content. But I guess once I ask the question, I am essentially doing it without permission. But should we pose the same question to the listeners that I posed to you when I was texting you from the gym locker room the other day? About a former Husky football player potentially named Bear. who would have played in the 90s. I met some guy in the locker room. He's a very nice guy. We our lockers were near each other. He was getting there. I was leaving. So we kind of were talking about how I had the preferred locker, the one that's right on the end. So it gives you a little bit more room. So I was taking my stuff out, and he's like, oh, I'm going to take your locker. I'm like, absolutely. He was a really nice guy, big guy. We chatted a little bit more about locker placement, as you would guess, and other things that I don't recall right now. He's a very nice guy. And then he starts talking to another guy in the locker room who they apparently had chatted before. They were saying hello again. I bowed out of the conversation. As I'm listening to these two fellas talk, my new friend, whose name I do not know, starts telling this other guy how he met the governor one time before he was the governor. He met Arnold Schwarzenegger. He takes out his phone and he shows a picture.
He was
of
the
him.
Lieutenant governor at the time, I believe.
That's right.
But it was a lot of people saw the next step for him. The next logical step is becoming the governor.
You know why he did this? He was talking about how little hair he has now and how he used to have more hair. And so he pulls out a phone to show a photo of him as a younger man in the 90s and how much hair he had. And, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, he's posing with him. He was, I think, actually filming Kindergarten Cop at the time. That would pan out early 90s. And anyway, this fella mentioned, he's like, yeah, he couldn't pronounce my name. He calls me Bill because I told him my name was Bear. Because I was playing for UW football at the time, and my nickname was Bear. And he just said it, but Schwarzenegger couldn't pronounce it, so he kept saying Bill. And that was the story. But there was something about the way he said it that made me think he was maybe a going concern in some way. Like, he might have been somebody who you know, if there's a football player named Bear on, you know, the UW team, maybe somebody would know that. Like, maybe he's a starter or something. I did a little Googling. I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
I could have gone to him and just said, hey, when did you play? Were you a starter? What position did you play? Other questions about football. But I was too shy to do that. And so now I'm just always wondering, did I meet somebody who was a, you know,
that was
a very,
I will tell
player?
You, a very random text from you, which was like, did you know a football player at the UW or like know of a football player who went with the nickname was Bear? And the answer is, I don't remember that, which you're kind of asking the right person. Actually, you should ask Danny O'Neill, because Danny O'Neill he was like the football reporter at the UW Daily when I was the swimming reporter. So I think we know who had the glam beat there.
Yeah.
And so he really knows that era of Huskies, kind of like mid-90s or like early 90s, mid-90s. But I do know, I did follow those teams very closely, and that nickname doesn't ring a bell, but I don't think that the guy's not you know, who he says he is. I just think, you know, I didn't know the answer to that, but you know, I would just say anytime you have questions from the locker room, text me, because you know, there's probably a lot that you don't know.
Is this a pimple or a boil?
Exactly. Attach photos if you want.
Yes.
How's your I'm asking this question, but my hope is that your answer is
short.
Everything is A-okay, so I can move on to my complaints.
Okay.
How's your garbage situation on this Monday?
Oh, great. Fantastic. Thank you for checking in. Yeah.
So I have a petty complaint that I'd like to make about my – it's not actually petty. Remember how on – I guess it would have been Friday's show, I was – while doing the show, these guys were installing a new washing machine here at Burbank Springs. The old one was having some problems, and – it was kind of tricky, the timing, because I was doing the show while they were – like, usually what's supposed to happen is they install it, they run a test, and then you sign some paperwork, and then they leave. Well, we needed to start the show, and so I signed the paperwork before they left. I just said, hey, can I – and so – and the guy said, oh, yeah, I got to run the washing machine. I'll run it on the full cycle, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay. And I remember while doing the show, after he left, it didn't take them very long at all. I thought – I was expecting to kind of hear some – noise coming, because actually where I am at right now is there's a closet and then a wall and then the laundry room. So I was thinking I was going to hear the washing machine going, and I didn't. And then later on that day, because we had so much laundry built up because we had not been able to do laundry for like weeks. So I get this huge pile and I start putting, you know, different whatever the darks in there, and it's full. And I put the detergent in, and I go to turn it on, and it doesn't turn on. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, this is probably just – there's a switch somewhere. And there's no switch. And then I get out the manual, and then I go online, and then I test the outlet that it's plugged into, because I thought, well, maybe – and I check the breaker switch, and it's like none of those things. And then I'm on the phone with Home Depot, The guy was actually so nice, the Home Depot phone guy. It's not his fault. But what he had to basically explain to me was, it's probably a defective product, but because it's manufactured by General Electric, they can't just bring us a new one or send someone out to fix this one. They have to send out a certified GE person who can't come out for like weeks to come look at it to tell us that it's officially not working, so then they can start the paperwork of sending us a new one. By the way, this is like a $400 washing machine. The service visit is probably – I mean, I'm not going to have to pay for it, but – this is almost it's funny because, you know, when they talk about durable goods in the economy, they are specifically talking about washers and dryers. It's often used as an example of a durable good. This is a disposable washing machine. It's like the cheapest one that Home Depot sells. It's like I should probably just order another one and have it brought out to replace this one. But now, because it's under some warranty, it's going to be months before we can do laundry here at home. And I'm so annoyed. It's not the specific guy at Home Depot's fault, but I'm so annoyed that this is the system. Somebody from DeWard and Bodie, which is a different appliance store, but the one that has the certification to check on GE brand products. We have to wait till they can send a person to come look at this washing machine.
So I'm a little confused about the installation guy. You said that he did run a test, or he said he was
told
going
me
to,
he was going
but
to,
he never did.
But I was not able to observe that happening, and I don't think he did. And I can't see, this is the thing. He was actually a really nice guy, and I really, even though he didn't give me enough props over doing a podcast, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, something he's working through. But I liked him, and he was really, he seemed super competent, and all that. But then I started having these sort of dark thoughts as I was on Friday night just like really frustrated that I now have loaded all this laundry in and then like dumped liquid detergent on it.
Yeah.
And I know I'm going to have to take this all out now and take it somewhere and wash it, which I did. Oh, and by the way, there's a laundromat in my neighborhood called Brio Laundry. Love that place. It was so – I mean, I guess the silver lining on this story is that I had such a nice time doing the laundry. Maybe because I don't have to do it that way all the time. But those washing machines are so big, and as are the dryers, and they have these big, nice tables for folding. I was like – again, if I had to do it – if I had a family like kids and I had to do it all the time, that wouldn't be fun. But as a kind of being a tourist in that world again, which was my world for many years, I was like, this isn't as bad as I remember it. Maybe laundromats have gotten nicer. But anyway, my dark thought was – did he actually try to run the test and then realize it wasn't going to work, but he'd already hooked it all up and he just didn't want to deal with it? So he just – because he walked by. Remember I told you he saluted me?
Yeah, I like that.
Can you imagine a world in which – so one of two things happened. Either – I guess one of three things happened. He ran the washing machine and it was working fine, and then for some reason it just burned out, and now it cannot be – there's no way to turn on any power on the washing machine. But in that case, he's totally blameless. Or he forgot to do his test cycle because I had signed the paperwork early and maybe, you know, his whole schedule was thrown off. That's the most innocent answer. He just forgot to do it. And the sinister one is that he tried to do it. It didn't work, but he knew because I was trapped in here hosting this godforsaken show – That I was no way I was going to be able to verify if he did the test or not. And he looked me right in the eye and he saluted me. And then he just went off with, you know, into the ether of Bellingham. Oh. And that's messed up. That's some Kaiser Solse shit.
If that's the case, you have some sort of a stolen valor complaint on your hands.
Majorly.
There.
Majorly.
I think. I don't know
majorly.
Exactly how that all works. But
yeah,
honestly,
sure.
Though, from everything you've told me, the most innocent explanation is also the most likely. I'll bet you you're right.
I agree.
The order of operations got turned on its head. So then you signed the paperwork. He just kind of – it slipped his mind, and he gave you the salute
yes.
in good faith.
That's what I think is the most likely scenario, because he was a nice guy, and he was not like – I mean, he was very professional. And I just think – I think he probably, like you and I, Andrew, he has – or particularly I'm thinking of you posting this show to the internet. There is a series of steps that happen, and if something is happening out of order – forget it. The whole operation is endangered.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's – but I am just – and again, I feel like I have to always sort of asterisk this stuff by saying there are so many people in the world that are dealing with such bigger issues than this. But it was just like a week ago we had a washing machine that didn't work, And we were like, well, let's buy a new one, and then we'll be able to do laundry again. And now we're in probably – we're now in a one-month holding pattern before we can do laundry in those. Somehow things got worse based on the delivery of a product that we have paid for.
Yes, and suddenly it feels like you – like – I can't wash my underwear until I get the approval of some GE certified technician. Like, that just doesn't seem right.
And that's not even going to be – I was thinking about that the other day. We were at Camaro Kev's on Saturday night, all of us, and he and I were talking about this. This is going to be a little – you're not going to enjoy this line of conversation, Andrew, but we were talking about underwear and how, like, when you're traveling or something, like this happened to me the other day. If you're traveling and you just have one bag and you don't have, for whatever reason, a laundry bag where you're throwing your dirty stuff, you're just kind of trying to keep your dirty stuff over in one side of the bag. But then it gets commingled, and then you have no choice but to try to figure out if this underwear has been worn or not. And there's just only one way to do it, and that's you got to sniff it. And I feel like there should be a little paper thing that they sell that you can rub on something that can indicate is this clean underwear or not. Because, you know, I don't like that that's still the system you have to use, because if it has been worn, that's not a fun experience, even if it's your own stuff.
Yeah, I don't like that. Can we go back to almonds and where they come from? No, I would like to say just always err on the side, like always err on the side of caution, or just assume.
Well, right,
if you don't know, assume.
Was,
but then what are you going to do? Like not wear underwear,
exactly.
Go out, maybe burn your whole suitcase and just go out and buy some new underwear. That's what you should do.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why you have to burn the suitcase. You could just buy the new underwear and put it back in the suitcase.
No,
because now you got to buy underwear. You got to buy a suitcase. I'm already out like $300 on this washing machine.
I'd say burn it. Just burn the whole thing, honestly.
Also, how have we not – we're overdue for the break here, but how have we not invented – I know I brought this up on the show before because people have emailed me about it. But whenever I'm spending any time thinking about washing machine technology – I don't understand how we don't have, in this day and age, a very effective washer-dryer machine. Something that washes it, and then the water drains out, and then it turns into a dryer. Or something that's like a washing machine that sits atop a drying machine, and when the clothing – when it's done, the washing machine opens up somehow the bottom, and it drops it down into the dryer, and then that dries it. Like, it's weird that with – I mean, you know, we can build a cyber truck, Andrew, and break its windows embarrassingly on stage, but we can't – but we're still like pulling wet clothes out of one machine and putting them into another machine to dry. That just seems very solvable.
I've never had that thought, and I am amazed by everything that you just said, especially the top to bottom one. Has nobody tried this? How have I not thought of it? One of my I love puttering and cleaning and doing, you know, those types of household related things. But yeah, there is something even here where I'm so lucky to have a full size washer and dryer in this apartment, something that we have not had in a lot of our apartments. But still, there's always that moment. And I don't think about it like kind of in the front of my mind when I'm doing it. But as you say it now, I hate that moment. I absolutely hate the moment of having to pull out big, you know, handfuls of wet clothes and move them in. Now, you know, there are going to be some complications. Not all clothes in one load can go into a dryer. So you're going to have to be thinking about in advance, like, is this a load that can go all in the dryer and et cetera. But that would be so great. And you're right. How have nobody thought of that? You would just like set the top, then set the bottom to whatever you want, then leave, go about your day. 3 hours later, you come back and it's all clean and dry.
I know. The big it seems doable. I'm sure someone has tried it, and I'm sure that there obviously is some kind of limitation or like kind of reason why it's not more common. But I do remember it must have been a – what's that big – like, I was going to say, I think it might be CES or something in Vegas, which is like a big kind of, I don't know, technology and gizmo conference that happens. And by that, I do mean there's a lot of gremlins there. Do not feed any of those tech people after midnight, or it's a bad scene. But like, you know, it's like there's always like these whiz-bang devices. And it was funny because a couple of years ago, the big news was that there was, I think, three or four different automatic laundry folding machines.
Oh, yeah.
And they were so ridiculous. Like, it was like looking at a computer. You know how you see that stuff sometimes? It's like all of the processing in your phone and like what we needed for that processing to happen in the 1970s, and it's like a small warehouse of just like mainframes. Like, look, and you think at the time, like, did they look at this and think this was a good system? Like, I'm looking at these laundry folding machines going, this is hilarious as of right now. Like, they're just enormously bulky thing, and you have to basically feed the laundry. Like, it's just, that is probably something that we will always need to do as human beings. Or there will, I mean, because it is so complicated to try to get something to fold laundry. You have to set all the laundry, you have to take all the t-shirts and lay them flat. Well, you've already done half of the work. Mm-hmm. Of the folding of the t-shirt at that point. What time is really saved that you carefully – it's like trying to feed a $20 bill into a slot machine at a casino. It's like it's so precise how everything has to be so that this robot thing can fold your laundry for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess the only thing would be if it was more of a commercial setting and it's not about the time saving but about the uniformity.
Yes.
You know, making sure that everything is folded to a certain standard, maybe. And then you have some, like, you know, teenager loading the shirts in and they're all coming out perfect on the other end.
Maybe. But, you were talking about pulling laundry out of the, like, wet laundry and throwing it in the dryer. I don't mind that as much. I really, for some reason, don't love folding laundry.
Mm-hmm.
But here's what I realized when I was at the laundromat on Friday. It's because we don't have a good place for it in our house. Like, we have lots of room in this house, but we never, like, set up, like, a big table, like a laundry table that a lot of people have. So what happens is when the laundry comes out, there's one of – either I throw it on the bed and then just, like, pull off pieces and fold them, or I do this weird cockamamie thing in the TV room because I like to watch TV while I'm doing it. But there's so much dog hair everywhere, even when we vacuum, that I'm always trying to, like, fold on this one section of this, like, small kind of coffee table. At the laundromat place, it was like I just had this big area and it was a lot easier and a lot faster. But generally speaking, I don't really love folding laundry. So that's where I would like to see some technological advances.
I would just like to say, because I'm just, you know, it'll always sting me, your rejection of the iPad lifestyle. I will tell you, man, you get yourself an iPad, you call up your Xfinity app on that thing, you can watch TV wherever you go. I have I don't love folding laundry, but it's gotten a lot better now that I can just, like, watch Chris Hayes while I fold laundry at my kitchen table. Give it a shot.
Well, that's – I mean, I do that, but I do that with my laptop.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But still, yeah. So I guess I could get a little bit. I should explore some other. Yeah, we have a big, big dining room table. I guess I could do it on too. Anyway. Okay. Enough about that. Let's take a quick break, and then we come back. I am actually really fascinated with all of the various developments in this art story. So we'll do that. We'll do some emails and V-mails. Oh, also, if we have time, Peloton Dad is bummed. He's the guy who plays the husband in the Peloton ad.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks his career is ruined, and then
he opens up to Psychology Today. Did you know that part?
Well, that's – yeah, I mean, where did you expect me to do the interview? Psychology Yesterday? It's a new show title. Psychology Yesterday V.2.
Or, by the way, I also wrote down, it's not a tuber as a possible show title. Just to, like,
oh, good. Yeah, see, that'll work
go
too.
Meta.
Just – yeah, I like it. All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more TVTL in just a moment. Who dis?
Velvet Underground. Can you think
of
why?
Course. I should recognize a Lou Reed when I hear one.
Can you picture this album cover now and realize why I'm playing it?
That's yes. Got you. Okay, sure. Right. The banana.
Told you the show's going to be bananas.
B-A-N-A-N-A-S. So, yeah, I don't... Coming off of our thoroughly factual conversation about The Mandalorian, let me just transition into... the New York art scene of the 1970s or whatever. So this is that's that famous cover. And then was that a Warhol? Did Warhol because but there that banana that's on the cover, there's a Warhol component to that, right? Is it a Warhol piece?
I think so, because it says Andy Warhol on the cover, and it's the banana.
So it was a Warhol piece, and then the Velvet Underground, who I'm sure were friends with him, then they use it as their album cover,
or he made it for them. I couldn't tell you that.
And then you have the Dandy Warhols of Portland, Oregon, who I don't want to shoot from the hip. I feel like I have a weird, I think there's the Dandy Warhols do a play on that Andy Warhol banana on one of their records too.
That would make sense. I'm trying to figure out. Yeah, but I know that the Velvet Underground and Andy Warhol, they were all part of the same scene, man.
Sure. So. Yeah, man. You know who's part of the scene known as keeping TBTL in business? Hmm. It's these donors of the day, man. They're like the Edie Sedgwicks of our little universe. See, me knowing one, probably the most famous member of the factory. Look at how I do. Ask me to name one other person associated with Andy Warhol. Can't do it.
Man, I don't. I remember really liking the movie I Shot Andy Warhol. Did you ever see that? That makes me want to see that again. That was one of those 90s.
That was Lily Taylor, though,
yes.
Right? I love Lily Taylor.
Yes, me too. And there was a period there where I felt like, don't worry, I'm sure there's some more. What do we want next? How about this one? Let's keep it upbeat. There was a period where almost every movie I watched had Lily Taylor in it in some way, right?
Yes.
It's almost like Lily Taylor became a genre, and I was very interested in whatever she was in. I liked that genre.
Yep. You and I were wishing on the same Lily Taylor from across the country, because I was, yeah, there was a period in college where every, like, Dogfight, which she's in with River Phoenix, great movie, shot in Seattle, scenes shot at the Nightlight in Seattle.
Oh, man, really, I love that place.
Yeah, it was just like, it just seemed like every movie I was watching, Lily Taylor showed up in it. That was definitely, you're right, that was a period of art house films where you were always seeing Lily Taylor and things.
Yeah.
All right. Lorraine Hirakawa of Puyallup, Washington. Really the Lily Taylor, I think, of this genre known as Donors of the Day.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we have Rebecca Ormsby of Plano, Texas. Plano, Texas, that would be the home of the... Isn't that the home of the Frito-Lay Empire?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Pretty sure that's...
Ooh, I got a little hungry when you said that.
I think that's where Frito-Lay corporate headquarters might be.
Can I ask you a quick question about that?
Yes, you can.
Which half of the Frito-Lay do you prefer, the Frito or the Lay's?
That's a great question.
Thank you.
Well, I know with Twix, I'm a right Twix guy. What do you think of those commercials?
I don't like them. They don't work for me. I appreciate that they've stuck with the concept, but I never thought the concept was that great to begin with. So I don't hate them, but I just always think you're trying too hard to make this a thing.
I guess the problem with – or the challenge with commercials is that I like – the job of a commercial is to sell the product. But – so that's why car commercials are so often just a car driving on a windy road. Mm-hmm. Because you just want people to think, oh, I would like to experience being in that car. But those aren't fun. Like, and so fun commercials often I feel like don't really sell the product that well. Like, I'm not more inclined to eat Twix because it's like a ghost or an apparition or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't – even the You Are Boring Me Back to Death and I'm mm-hmm. Already Dead commercial, it doesn't make me want to go eat – is it Starburst? I don't even remember the product. So that's a bad sign.
That was Starburst, right? We just played that. It was Skittles or Starburst.
Yeah.
Starburst.
But those but I like the commercials where they take a shot. Like, I like the commercials where they just do something funny. But I also recognize that if it was my money – I might like if I was the client, I might be like, are we moving product with this commercial? Are we just entertaining some failed screenwriters at this advertising agency who are getting to write these 30-second movies now? And you know what I mean? That would be my issue with that. Okay.
Can I just say one thing about that though? Since you
Please.
Do raise it, I think in this case the moving product aspect comes in with the packaging, because now Twix has taken this whole "Are you a left Twix or a right Twix person?" and now they sell Twix, and you can choose whether you're buying two left Twix or two right Twix. Obviously, it's all just absurdist.
That's pretty clever, actually.
But it's kind of clever, and I do think like Snickers has been doing this for a while, like putting little sayings on their candy bars in that very famous Snickers font. And so my thought about this now is they're trying to get you while you're making an impulse buy, waiting in line at the 7-Eleven or the grocery store, and you see it like kind of like, oh yeah, I'm going to go to this thing because I want the Snickers that says hangry on it, right? Like just like that split second, that split second decision, and you're like, oh, they have right Twix. I'm going to get me a couple of right Twixes. I could sort of see how that plays in.
It's an awareness thing.
Yeah.
And I guess you're right. I mean, that's the old Rich Hall joke on Letterman, which I quote it all the time. I should actually go find the footage of it. But he used to do this joke about Coke and Pepsi spending $1 billion a year on marketing so that someone – so he goes, so that this can happen. You're at a restaurant. Can I have a Coke, Pepsi, all right? Yeah, fine.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Like it seems like a waste, but just it's hard to figure out that awareness thing. Just like it's seeping into your brain. And like you said, you're standing in line at a mini mart or at a gas station and you look down and you just have some context for Twix and you have less context for Abba Zaba. And so maybe you reach for the Twix.
Right, exactly.
All right, Jennifer Berman or Burman of Jersey City, New Jersey. Thank you for donating to the show. I looked up, by the way, I don't know if the Frito-Lay world headquarters are in Plano or they just have a facility there because I just did a – I mean, I would say that Frito-Lay is very, very much in the greater Dallas area. And you're talking about a lot of kind of – like it looks like maybe the headquarters are in Fort Worth, Texas. This just took such a turn. We'd like to thank sponsor Frito-Lay also for helping keep the show going. What if that was just integrated content that we were doing? That like we didn't tell the listeners that the donations of the day, they're nice, but really what's paying for this is Frito-Lay, and I have to work it into each donor.
It would be ironic that the one part of the show that we decide is sponsored content is we sponsor the part where we thank people who gave us money. To answer my own question, by the way, I'm much more of a Frito guy. If I had to choose between Fritos and Lay's, Fritos are for me.
Oh, but you consider Fritos to be basically like Fritos, like the extruded corn chip thing that kind of looks like a acrylic fingernail. That's what you're talking about. Fritos, as we think of them, versus Lay's potato chips.
Yes, which, you know, like my dad, I think he would die on the Lay's hill. He loves a Lay's potato chip.
And what a way
to
die, though.
I know.
Just on a pile of Lay's potato chips and just eat your way to the bottom.
Homer Simpson style.
See, okay, so this is my relationship with Fritos. Frito corn snacks, corn-based snacks. I like them about once a month. I tend to have them on the ferry, like in the Washington State ferries, the like snack bar there. I have this ritual. I'll grab a bag of Fritos and whatever Diet Cola product they happen to have. And I enjoy that. It's kind of my ritual on the ferry. Mm-hmm. But I don't like go out and buy Fritos. There's something like I feel they're very oily, not like potato chips are exactly a health dream. But if I were to eat like – if I were to power through – a bigger bag of Fritos than I meant to or a bigger bag of potato chips than I meant to, I would feel not like worse calorically, but just – those are something that I enjoy on a rare occasion. They're kind of a treat for me. But if I ate them every day, I don't think I'd feel great.
Yeah, and we don't really keep chips in the house except for Genevieve likes to keep tortilla chips and salsa as a quick snack. But for the most part, like I don't keep Fritos in the house because, well, first of all, I would just eat them too much, right? But on the occasion, you know when a bag of Fritos enters my life on like a work trip or something where I'm staying in a hotel and I need to get something from the snack center downstairs, I'm probably going to – I'm going to get a potato chip bag, it'll probably be Fritos, probably because I think it's the most –
The irony is that's not potato, but yes.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay, I'll call them crisps. I'm going to get a bag of crisps, I'll get that because probably I find them the most satisfying. Like, if I'm hungry, then I feel like I'm going to get like kind of more for my money with a bag of Fritos.
Yeah, I can see that. I think we're talking about the same thing, which they seem very calorically dense to me in a way. Maybe part of it is, and this comes up on the show a lot too, what's called the caloric vanishing point, which is that engineered moment where you're eating something but you don't actually realize how full you're getting, so you keep eating it. And a lot of these snacks are very engineered in that way. And they need to work on the engineering of the Fritos, because I know when I'm full of Fritos, like pretty quickly. I'm like, There's a lot of Fritos. I'm enjoying this, but oh, I'm getting full fast. Whereas like Lay's potato chips, they're so impossibly sort of thin and salty, and again, almost like just like, you know, you just drop them on your tongue and they're just dissolving. I can really, same thing with Pringles. I could really do some damage before my body realizes that was too many Pringles.
Yeah, too many Pringles.
We can never have too many donors of the day, though. And in fact, there are three more I'd like to point out and honor today. Emily Finger of Somerville, Massachusetts. I offer that without any accent. Mm-hmm. I offer that without any attempted accent. I just say Emily Finger of Somerville, Massachusetts. And then Christy Brookhouse of Belleville, Ontario. Mm-hmm. And then Michael Grant of Jillaby, New South Wales, once again.
Another one. Wow.
Australia checking in. And I think we can agree, Jillaby, pretty on brand for Australia.
Right. Definitely.
As I tweeted out when we were leaving, everybody in Australia, at least the parts we were in, is from some place called Humpty Ringadoo. And the most amazing part about it was they assume you know where that is.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, we would be... Like, remember when we were talking to the world's biggest Madonna fan at the Tennant Creek Caravan Park? And then in that same kind of, what would you call it? Snack shop, I guess. Crisp shop, I call it. There was a woman that came in the next day when we were checking out who had, like, a bird on her shirt.
Oh, yeah.
Like a live bird.
Yes, right.
And she was great. And I was talking to her, and I asked if I could take a picture of her and the bird. And then she was just telling me about the town they were from. But it was all with this assumption that I knew exactly where that was. But it was like population 40, and it's in the outback. And I clearly am not from Australia. Like, have you heard me talking?
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the things that I found so interesting about the Australians that we encountered. It just, to them, it seemed impossible that we wouldn't know everything about Humpty Ringadoo.
Like me just assuming she knows something about Brunswick, Ohio, outside of
exactly.
Valley City, where I grew up.
That's right. And it was kind of great because, in a way, like, I thought we were going to be treated as these real oddities because we were kind of going to the not as well-known part of Australia. But we really weren't, as I'm remembering. People were mostly not fascinated by us.
There is a pattern I got to point out. Like, you really want people to be fascinated. Like, when you told the washing machine guy, the fraudulent washing machine guy, I will update that description, or the forgetful washing machine guy. You know, he was unimpressed with the fact that you said you had to go record a podcast. You were disappointed by nobody asking. Because I remember being in a gas station with you in Australia, and you're just like, and finally somebody said, oh, you're from the U.S. That's cool. And I remember you were like, finally. Like, it took 4 days for somebody to acknowledge the fact that we're fish out of water.
Okay, let me just wrap this up. I don't want to drag these fine donors of the day into what is about to be a very tense conversation.
Oh, no.
Michael, Christy, Emily, Jennifer, Rebecca, and Lorraine, thank you very much for donating to what is probably the last episode of TBTL. So you really picked a good one. Now, here's my logic on that, such as there is any logic. It isn't – I mean, okay, on some – deep, 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 deep buried level, it is probably that I want to feel special in the eyes of this person at the – what was it called? Like OTG on the go? That was a big gas station chain there that we kept popping into. And I believe we were at an OTG when somebody – that was also the place where they were selling they were selling sausages called bum burners. They were like spicy sausages. And I wrote on Twitter, what's your favorite sausage that makes your bunghole hurt? Mine's bum burners. Oh, just right there in the name.
God.
But anyway, I'm sure that a little bit of it is wanting to be somehow special or something. But it isn't that I wanted us to go through Australia with people constantly being like asking us a bunch of silly questions or being like, oh my God, how did you get here? But I am just saying that if I were in whatever the equivalent of the outback is of the United States and there just wasn't a lot going on and somebody came through and they had an Australian accent, it would just stand out to me in its unexpectedness. Like, and that's what I'm always surprised about. And even with the guy and the podcast thing, I actually didn't even want to tell him, the washing machine guy, I didn't even want to tell them that I do a podcast because I felt embarrassed about it. The reason that I mentioned it was because they were going to be walking past a window where I am currently talking into a microphone. And I was more embarrassed with them thinking that I had lost my marbles and was just a guy. Oh, old man Burbank. He goes into a room and talks into a microphone. He hasn't been right since the war.
It's
like, I didn't want them.
It's not even plugged in.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I didn't want them to think that I am suffering from some delusion in this room. And so that being the more embarrassing, like, read. And again, this is all narcissistic because this assumes that they give and they're giving much more thought to my existence than they are. And that's, I guess, kind of the that's the launch pad of this mission into my massive and unending insecurity. OK, but Houston, we have a boner. But so I explained the podcast thing to him only out of trying to avoid what felt like a more embarrassing thing to me, which was him just looking at me doing this, being like, what the hell is going on with that guy? That being said, of all of the deliveries that they have made, probably in their career delivering appliances, I'm willing to bet that I am the first person who said to them, can I sign the paperwork first because I have to go record a podcast for my job? I am confident, unless they were delivering recently to Marc Maron, I am very confident in saying that's the first time that's happened. And when anything happens to me for the first time, I'm usually like, oh, that's the first time that's happened. So it's what I really think my confusion is it's probably somewhat about wanting them to be like, ooh, podcast, cool, high five. But more it's just I don't understand the mindset of people when you tell them a piece of information that does not fit in with the historically the information they've heard in that moment. Like if somebody said, I'm a live Build-A-Bear model, I would go, what? Mm-hmm. Like I don't care about Build-A-Bear. But I care about having never met someone who live models for Build-A-Bear. I don't even know how that would work. Why would they have a human doing that job? But if you
get
tell
bears
me,
to do
like,
that.
Well, that's the thing. Right. It's a union thing.
Yeah.
And the Bears Union is remarkably, I have to say, effective. And I support that.
So if you meet a human and they say, I'm a live Build-A-Bear model, you have to start screaming scab at them. Okay. Can we agree on that?
Yeah. I'll inflate a rat.
Yeah. This is why you got to have the tough conversation sometimes because important stuff comes out of it. Yeah.
You get there. No, but anyway, I know that I probably do want to be perceived as special and fascinating. I will admit to that. But more it's just I don't understand. Maybe it's just people just don't care or they don't listen or maybe some people's reaction or their response when they are confused is to just not stop everything and go, huh? It's just to keep moving. That's probably the more likely thing. I'm not one of those people. When I'm confused, I grind everything to a stop. And as we say, I stop the show.
Stop the show.
Because I'm trying to understand what's going on. That's my reaction. But there's a lot of people that their reaction is probably just keep the conversation moving. Pretend like you didn't hear that. Because that's just their response to confusion.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't know that you'll agree with this. In fact, you probably won't. But I just think that podcasting is way less rare than you're giving credit for. I think that, I mean, he doesn't know that we're doing one officially for American Public Media. And, you know, I think there's something special. You and I are both proud and thankful that we do this for our job, which is really cool. But obviously, you're not getting into all that with them. Like, I feel like so many people, you click on their Twitter bio and they have some kind of a podcast. Now, I'm not saying, you know, I'm not comparing and contrasting the frequency of those podcasts or the quality or whatever. But I just think that the term,
yeah,
or the phrase, I have to go record my podcast now, is probably a lot less rare than we're giving it credit for.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also, he was a younger guy, and so it's very possible he's a gamer, and there's millions of people on Twitch who are doing basically their streaming, their gameplay, their podcasting. You know, you're right. It's way more common than it used to be. And what I should have told him is, I need to sign this paperwork because I have to go into that room and tape a banana to the wall because I'm an artist.
Good transition.
See what I did there?
Hello and welcome to Top Story.
All right, our top story today, the banana art piece that basically shut down Art Basel in Miami. It didn't actually shut down Art Basel, but it had to be removed from the, I guess you could say, pavilion it was in because there was such a crush of people trying to see this banana that is duct taped to a wall. It's a piece of work from the artist Maurizio Catalan. If that sounds familiar, it's because it's the same guy who did the gold toilet.
Still missing,
that we talked
right?
About.
Got jacked.
Still missing. I know. I went down a sort of an update rabbit hole on that. For folks that missed that episode of the show, well, wow, you really missed out because that was a good one. That golden toilet that was, I believe, at the Guggenheim in New York for a while that this guy made, then was installed in a gallery space in the UK where it was stolen from this sort of castle, which I guess is like where Winston Churchill used to go on vacation or something crazy. I was reading an update on what all the townspeople think happened to it. Like, they think it's buried somewhere in the town. Everyone has a theory. In fact, most of the people think it's all a fraud, like that this was all a setup by Maurizio Catalan. There's no evidence of that, by the way. And one of the reviews that I actually read of this banana piece, the New York Times art critic kind of begrudgingly sort of tips his cap to this piece that this guy Maurizio did. And he goes on to describe Banksy as being a total fraud. The art critic for the New York Times hates Banksy. And he's drawing this distinction between what this guy, Catalan, does and what Banksy does. I didn't follow it because I don't really understand art. Mm-hmm. But one of the things he felt bad about on behalf of this, like, he loves this Maurizio guy. And he feels like the fact that everyone thought that he staged the heist of the toilet, he basically blames Banksy for that because Banksy is so pranksy. Mm-hmm. Maybe a medium. He basically blames this kind of art prank culture on Banksy, which means that if you're Maurizio Catalan and you have your piece legitimately stolen from a castle, everyone just thinks it's this meta joke. And so he was very protective of Maurizio. Okay, so can you tap dance for 1 minute? Because I'm trying to
call up the article. Yeah, well,
what's
I will
the
say
most
this.
Boring way? What's the most boring way into this? Can I try? Can I try the most boring way into
sure,
this story?
Yeah, do it.
Okay, so I actually, in printing out a bunch of stuff this week for some pre-tape shows that we're doing, I don't have any more printer paper. So I'm actually reading these articles off of my computer. But the problem is when I click on a link in my email, it tries to use Google Chrome to open the link. But Google Chrome doesn't know that I subscribe to the New York Times. And so it won't let me read the article. So I have to copy the link and then go into a different browser that knows that I'm paying my hard-earned money for the New York Times. And I just did it, and now I'm here. What was your tap dance going to be?
I was just going to say, talking about these stories, like I always get a little anxious when I see that you have a topic in a show sheet that says, like, is this art? Because I always feel like I'm the least – I feel like I guess I'm anxious about – pretending like I am somebody who has an answer to that question, not unlike the almond conversation we're having before. Obviously, this is a subjective question, but also, like, I feel very unqualified because I know so little about the art scene. But I find it very interesting that the New York – I feel like the New York Times art critic gives me a little cover. Like, I feel relieved to know that he's annoyed by Banksy because I generally am too. But I also don't feel emboldened
enough
to, like –
I'm into the Banksy stuff.
I feel like all that Pranksy stuff, like you said, Banksy. Hey, where do I come up with this stuff? Where do I come up with it? I think –
You're derivative. You're a derivative podcaster.
Especially lately, like with that – the shredded – oh, God. That shredded painting
piece of art.
Yeah, I hated that. Yeah.
Is that party that you aren't going to go to? Was there going to be a self-destruction of art after the group sing-along?
Maybe.
So the piece itself is called Comedian, and – it is a real banana that was just randomly bought at some like grocery store in Miami, and it is duct taped and actually kind of glued to the wall. How do I know that it's kind of glued? Because if you bought this piece, and there was an edition of three of them, so collectively $390,000 were spent on three versions of this taped banana. By the way, it does not come with the tape or the banana. That's on you. What you get are a set of instructions written by this guy on how to do this banana thing. And that's why I know there's glue, because I've read the instructions. And
yeah, it's weird. The New York Times printed the instructions. So then that gets into even more than what is the value of art. I did not realize. I thought that you do get the tape and a banana, but you'll just have to replace the banana. But that's not true. They don't give you anything. They don't give you any of the actual physical items, huh?
They don't give you any of the physical stuff. And it's on you to replace the banana yourself.
And to buy the first banana, it sounds like.
You have to buy the first banana. You have to buy the duct tape. You have to buy the glue. You have to tape it up there. Then if it goes, if it turns bad and you want to change it out, you got to change out the banana yourself. Because what they're, what the piece of art is a concept. Now, this has created such a stir at Art Basel that they there was a board, not a riot, but there were so many people trying to get near the banana, take a picture with the banana, that it was a security issue. They had the Miami Police Department in there trying to crowd control and effectively guard the banana. Then this this performance artist shows up, and his name is David Datuna. He's based in New York. He shows up, and then he just starts eating the banana. He walks up. I don't know how he got past the police. Maybe the police hadn't actually been installed yet. Maybe they were there as a result of this. He walks up. He takes the banana down off the thing. He eats the banana while videotaping it there and puts it on Instagram. It's a new performance piece called Hungry Artist by him eating the banana. This was apparently not cleared with the original artist, Maurizio Catalan, but he's not mad about it. He does not plan to sue this guy because, as his manager says, Maurizio's manager says, it's not about the banana. It's a concept. So the guy eating the banana did not ruin the art.
I didn't get to that part of the story. I did get to part of the story where the original artist said that these bananas came from a random grocery store in Miami. So yeah. In case you're curious as to whether or not these are special bananas, they are not. I mean, maybe all bananas are special. I don't know. I don't care for them. I will say
to
this.
Someone.
I did not realize this was a story until you sent the show sheet this morning, but in just random scrolling, I have seen this photo of the banana taped to the wall somewhere. I don't know if somebody I follow has seen it in person and took a photo and posted it to Instagram. Maybe somebody retweeted something. I have no idea. But I will say this. When I saw it, I remember thinking, ooh, that's a cool photo. I don't even like bananas, yeah. But that's really cool. So there was something visually stimulating to me about this banana taped to the wall.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's interesting in the same way that Andy Warhol banana is interesting. You know, bananas are kind of this combination. And like, I'm not trying to get my art criticism on here, but like bananas are an interesting thing because they're kind of beautiful and bright and interesting visually, but then they also deteriorate very rapidly, and that's extremely visual as well. So there's the comic aspect. By the way, I think I mentioned this, but this is called Comedian. This piece is called Comedian. There's the, you know, slipping on a banana peel. When do you think that happened?
Yeah.
Because honestly, like, there are so many things that are more slippery than a banana peel. Like, what's the origin of banana peel, slipping on a banana peel being such a known joke? Like, I feel like there are just so many other things that would have been more likely to become the go-to cartoon pratfall of I'm going to slip on something, it's going to be a banana peel.
I don't know for sure, obviously, but I have a strong feeling it involves a clown. I mean, it's got to be from Clownery, right? Big red shoe, little yellow banana peel. There's something
I like it.
You know,
I'm hearing the comedy.
That's where it's that's where it's coming from.
But the other thing that this New York Times art critic writes about with this piece and says this is why it's not just he's not just trying to, because you know obviously in a way this is if you are somebody who takes a sort of dim view of modern art, this is red meat for you, as it were. I mean, this is really going to be quite triggering, because the idea of taping a banana to a wall and then people paying collectively almost $400,000 for the idea of the banana to the wall, I mean, that's everything people who think modern art is bullshit. That's everything that they would ever expect in a modern art piece. But what the New York Times art critic writes is that this whole taping things to a wall, this is a whole move for Maurizio Catalan. He did a piece called A Perfect Day at a gallery, I think in Italy, where he duct taped the gallery's owner, who I think is also his art manager, to the wall for the entire first day of the show. And there's a picture of it, and it's like that totally like that fraternity prank where you duct tape someone to a wall with like a million pieces of duct tape. And it's the friggin' gallery owner. He's duct taped like pretty high off the ground. I want to say like 6-7 feet off the ground. And so suspending things has been – that's part of this guy's move. Like, he had a retrospective at – I think it might have been MoMA. He had Catalan had a retrospective a few years ago at a very influential museum in New York. Maybe it was the Whitney. But anyway, he chose to display all of his work, hanging it down from the ceiling in this kind of weird tornado of art. So he's into suspending things. So he's been kind of – this is a consistent as far as his, I guess you could say, oeuvre.
So that kind of, again, kind of gives it legitimacy, right, when it's part of a bigger body yeah. of art. Although I'm still not 100% sure that that thing with the gallery owner wasn't actually just a hazing ritual. I mean, could that be it? Were these guys in a frat? He hazed this guy and then to
an Italian art frat?
Yeah, and then to avoid any kind of repercussions, he's like, no, it's an art project. And then he just started taping all kinds of shit to the wall. Like he just really doubled down on it.
I mean, you do – this is the thing. You do start to wonder what is and isn't art, because I ended up reading a lot about this guy Catalan today. And he seems delightful. He's very reminiscent of like Roberto Benigni, the Life is Beautiful guy.
Yeah.
I mean, not in just that they're both Italian, but that he's like – he's sort of an impish prankster. He seems like a lovely dude. And again, the New York Times art critic would say that there's something behind it. It's not just – being kind of kooky for kookiness sakes. Like, they end up going on this art tour in this museum. Again, I think it's the Whitney. And this guy knows every single thing about every single piece that's in there. And this is modern stuff. This is stuff that involves Philando Castile, the guy that the African-American who was basically executed by police in Minnesota. And this guy knows everything about all of these pieces. So it's not like he's just some jokester guy who doesn't have any thought towards art. Like, he really thinks about art. That being said, he's like wandering on the streets in front of the museum going like, and the museum's closed. They're going to get a special tour because he's hanging out with the New York Times. And he's like out there, like on like one of those, like he's out there on a little bike riding around trying to get people. He's like, pay me $60 and I'll let you see anything you want in this museum. Like, he's in constant kind of like, he was in the Biennale one year, which is a big, the Biennale is this art thing that moves between Venice, Italy and the Whitney in New York. And I think it's like every 2 years or maybe, yeah, I think it's like every 2 years. It's like very prestigious to be in there. And he was in there, I think, for Italy, and he sold his spot to an advertiser and they put up a big ad in his spot that I think was an ad for like a purse or something or a perfume or whatever. So it's like his move is to always mess with whatever the conventional notion of anything is, which is also why when they're like, can we show your art? And he's like, let's hang it all from the ceiling. Mm-hmm. There's a little Willy Wonka in there. Yeah, right. But I'm kind of on board for it. He seems basically harmless and creating an interesting conversation about what is and isn't art, I guess, or just, I don't know, what constitutes art.
Can we go back to this idea? I mean, there are two aspects of the kind of controversy over art like this, right? The is it art question, which I just don't think anybody can ever answer that in almost right. any case.
Totally.
But the other question is the how money is involved with art. And it sounds like he's actually kind of trying to address that with some of his stunts as well. If he was kind of sold out to the highest bidder so that they could sell perfume or a bag or advertise those things. But like, I'm interested in this idea that he's selling a set of instructions to recreate the art mm-hmm. itself, which yeah. That's actually interesting. I think that's cool, this idea of art not being an object that you own, but an idea. But then why – I just can't get over then why are some people paying – how much does it go for? How many thousands of dollars?
Between 120 and I think 150. I mean, the total was $390,000. Divided by three, but not everyone paid the same price, which would also be rough. If you were yeah. the person that had to pay an extra $60,000, like somebody got the banana thing, they got like the first edition for – maybe the first edition was – because it's three editions of the directions, okay? And I believe they're probably signed by him.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's the piece. That's what you have. What you have is – and I assume it's framed – is you have this piece by this very well-regarded artist that is framed in your home or business about the banana. And I mean, talk about a conversation starter. And then you, I guess if you choose to, maybe if you're having a big party, you tape a banana up but it's just like a Tuesday. You just don't have the energy. You don't tape a banana up. I guess that's how that works.
Oh, man. I just, but it's just Monday.
I got a case of the Mondays. Like, I got no, you know what? Please, I just have to apologize before you come over. I haven't had time to tape up any bananas.
Oh, man. Next Hey Dummies we do, we should stand in front of a wall just filled with bananas taped up there. Anyway, I'm just interested in that, like, because now the New York Times has a step-by-step guide that they created to make this banana. I think I mentioned that earlier. And those aren't worth $120,000, right? But these other things are. Like you said, it's a piece. Maybe it's framed. It's signed. It is displayable. I guess that's the good argument for it. But does the fact that anybody can also have a set of instructions or recreate this, does that devalue the originals at all? Like, what is
Right. Like, if I tape a banana up here in the broadcast center, I mean, is that art? And is it, am I making a meta statement? Because most art you can't recreate because it's hard. Like, I can't paint, you know, like the Mona Lisa or something. I just physically can't do it. And most art is sort of complicated to actually generate. This is a piece of art that I could actually do. So if I just did put this up in my house, is that art? Am I ripping him off? Am I building on the project that he started? Is it a meta commentary on his piece? Is it derivative? I mean, there are a lot of questions around that.
Yeah, I had not done a lot of reading about this. I only had scanned that article that you sent me this morning, which addresses everything we're talking about. But now I'm on the New York Times and I see that they have dedicated a lot of ink to this. They still use ink. They've dedicated a lot of ink to this. And I'm seeing that in Critics Notebook, they have a headline, "A Grudging Defense of the $120,000 Banana."
That's the article that I've been citing kind of loosely.
Gotcha.
That's the guy. His name is Jason Farrago, and he's writing about this. And he's the one that kind of calls. Let me see if I can find the Banksy thing. He's the one who's very not a fan of Banksy's work. He also mentioned something. You'll enjoy this. Let's see. Exactly because of frauds like Banksy. It's exactly because of frauds like Banksy that audiences believe Mr. Catalan arranged the theft of his own gilded commode in September from Blenheim Palace, as if every artist were putting something over. Actually, real artists are not out to hoodwink you. What makes Mr. Catalan a compelling artist and what makes Banksy a tedious and culturally irrelevant prankster precisely Mr. Catalan's willingness to implicate himself within the economic, social, and discursive systems that structure how we see and what we value. That's the part that I didn't fully understand, because his point is that this guy is making himself also, like, he's sort of being self-aware about it. But I mean, he sold a piece recently for $17 million, and he's presumably still got, you know, half of that or whatever he got after taxes and his art manager. So I don't know. I don't understand. I don't know enough about his work or anyone else's to say if he's inside the system or outside the system, or if he's in on the joke. Or to me, it's like, if you get $8 million selling something that's a piece of art, making fun of the art world, you're still making the $8 million or whatever it is, you know? But
I think it also helps that we know who he is and we can talk to him, and the New York Times can interview him and he can talk about his art. Mm-hmm. I think one of the frustrating things for people who don't like Banksy too is, like, your mm-hmm. whole life is just like this pompous idea of, ooh, you're a secret prankster and we don't know who you are. Like, you're not going to sit down and actually have a conversation about art. Maybe you do with your friends, but I mean, I think that adds to it as well.
The thing that jumped out about this one of these pieces too that I had never known was, it's on the subject of people interacting with art, because of course the guy that ate the original banana from this thing, which just makes me laugh saying it out loud because it's so dumb, the whole thing, but it kind of in a fun way. Do you know that John Lennon and Yoko Ono met because Yoko Ono had an art show in London, and there was an apple that was part of it, which sounds pretty on brand for Yoko Ono. And John Lennon walked up, picked up the apple, and took a bite out of it?
No, I didn't know that. That's some ballsy shit.
I know. That feels sort of on brand for John Lennon. Mm-hmm. And I don't know by 66... how famous are the Beatles at that point? Well, they'd have to be fairly famous.
Oh, big, yeah.
So it's like, so you got John Lennon walks into this gallery, and everybody knows he's John Lennon. And Yoko Ono knows he's John Lennon. We're in London right now. And she's doing a piece where, of course, she put an apple out because she's Yoko Ono. And then he just, like, walks up and he's like, I guess I'll have a bite of that. That's a really bad Bill Clinton.
No, not
sorry.
As bad as like, it could have been.
Like, there's something about that that I actually don't find to be a meet cute. I find it to be annoying.
Yeah, and like an assault.
Yeah, because it's like John Lennon is... That just feels very John Lennon to me. Like, look at me. Which I don't necessarily think was his vibe. Like, I think he obviously had a very complicated relationship with how famous the Beatles got. But the idea that John Lennon walks into an art show and then there's like an apple there that's part of the work and then he just goes and just like takes a big bite of it and puts it back down. It just feels like you're like why don't you just piss in all the corners and just really mark this territory?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely about, I guess, a power dynamic or a fame dynamic. But I also think it speaks to like how he really fancies himself an artist that went beyond pop music, right? And so that he feels so at home in an avant-garde, you know, art showing or art house that he can feel emboldened to go and interact with the art because he's on the same page with these folks, right?
Oh, this is interesting. I'm reading now at the MoMA website about this. So apparently Lennon comes in the day before the gallery, the art show was open. So this is like somewhat empty gallery. And this is Yoko Ono talking about it. She says, and then he saw the apple. You know, he didn't say anything. He just grabbed it and had a bite in it. I think she means, you know, took a bite of it. The apple was fresh on an installation like this, and he just grabbed it and bit it and looked at me like, you know, there, you know, I was so furious. I didn't know what to say, and it all showed in my face. How dare this person, you know, mess around with my work? So he just said, I'm sorry, and just put it on the stand again. So that was apparently how they met.
Wow. Well, it worked, I guess.
Yeah, kind of.
Kind of.
Let's see. Just because I'm constantly promoting things and constantly not getting to them, let me just mention a little follow-up here because I talked about it at the top of the show. Remember we were talking about this Peloton ad with the – now she's been titled Peloton Wife. This woman gets – you know, her husband gets her a Peloton bike and then she embarks on a year-long journey of riding it and whatever. Everybody knows about the ad. It's a whole thing. Well, when we talked about it originally, I cited a stat – I want to say from the Washington Post that said something about Peloton's stock being up in the aftermath of the ad. And I think I had asked the question is, you know, is Peloton, are they, you know, kind of, are they winning out? Are they winning in this because they're actually getting a lot of attention and we're all talking about them? But then I was reading this New York Magazine article this morning that says that their stock went down by what's worth $1.5 billion. Their stock plunged 15% in 3 days. Now, Peloton is saying that the stock drop is not related to the ad, but it happened right after the ad came out.
I've noticed this weekend we watched two full football games and we did not see this ad that was in very heavy rotation. There's another Peloton.
There's a new one
ad,
now.
Yeah.
Which is actually Christmas Day and it's like a dad riding it, right?
Yes, although I will say I don't think that has been created in the aftermath. I think it was running concurrently, and I think they've just pulled the other one. It just the other one, the we'll say quote unquote new one. It's just not there's not a lot to make it memorable. I mean, that's again goes to this one ad is kind of hateable and cringeworthy, but everybody was talking about it. This other one is kind of like, oh yeah, it's Christmas morning and the lights are going. Well, I can't remember, the lights are flashing or something, and the dad is like just exercising, and it's not that memorable.
This is from BusinessInsider.com. Peloton's nightmare before Christmas. $1.5 billion vanishes from its market valuation in 3 days amid holiday ad backlash.
Wow.
So who knows if – I mean, it could have been an earnings report. I mean, there could have been other things that were driving this. But, I mean, according to this one article in this one written by someone named Theron Muhammad, basically this is because – of the social media backlash and the fact that they're just having Peloton's steep stock decline could reflect the weight that investors put on consumer sentiment towards the brand enduring relationship with users. Daniel McCarthy, assistant marketing professor at Emory University, told Forbes, it can cause companies like Peloton to exhibit a lot more stock price volatility when there are events that can cause people's views to move up or down. I think that's exactly what we're seeing right now. Now, here's the thing. I'm no Kai Rizdahl. But, I mean, the idea of its stock, it lost 15% maybe because it was in the news for a bad thing. But if it's underlying, if the business model is sound, if the fundamentals of Peloton are working, I'm sure they'll make that back up, and I'm sure the company will be fine long term. Mm-hmm. This is kind of like you're in a casino and you have a bankroll, and you're in the moment where you lost some of your bankroll, but ideally you will get it back. And you know, this is kind of their bankroll went down a little bit, but it could conceivably come back if it's a good business model. But that is pretty crazy. If even in the temporary, they lost $1.5 billion from people not liking that ad.
Yeah, Veeves and I were talking about this. As a matter of fact, we recorded our After These Messages that will be airing this Tuesday early because of some travel stuff. So at the time, we didn't even know about this this market plunge, but we were speculating about whether or not this is good in the short term, long term, whatever, because Peloton is on everybody's mind, right? And sometimes, you know, bad press is still press, and it's getting the name recognition out there. I think we kind of both agree that Genevieve said, in the short term, for the holidays, if there is a fella who's kind of been maybe toying with the idea of giving his wife or partner a Peloton, and then I think this commercial is disliked for more nuanced reasons than just the kind of broad faced, like, you don't get a woman an exercise machine for Christmas, right? Because there are plenty of examples where that's totally fine. You're replacing somebody's exercise bike. You know that your partner loves to exercise. I mean, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with that, depending on what your relationship is like. But if there is somebody who's kind of on the fence, and it's a guy, and he's kind of like, oh, you know what? All I'm hearing is like people saying, don't get your wife exercise bike for Christmas. Like, it could impact sales in the short term. But I think in the long term, this will all blow over. And this has just cemented the name Peloton to motionless bike. I almost said it again. Stationary bikes. I think that it's I don't know why this keeps happening. But I
want someone in our listening audience to get their partner
a motionless
bike. It doesn't have to be Peloton. It could be whatever. But please put on the tag, enjoy this motionless bike.
What if that's my art? You know, like I submit some sort of Peloton, but literally the pedals won't move on it. And that's where the art comes in. But anyway, just to finish my thought. Yeah, I think in the long term, this is just going to be brand recognition for Peloton. And they're getting probably a boost from this in the long run.
Meanwhile, Peloton Dad, as he's now being called, he's an actor named Sean Hunter. He's an elementary school teacher in Vancouver, Canada, mere miles from where I sit right now. He is kind of bummed out about this, he says, because he has been kind of sweat. He's only in the commercial for like a couple seconds because the commercial is really about the Peloton mom. But he is upset, he says, because of all of the backlash towards him, that he's part of the patriarchy, that like the idea is like to the degree that some people were mad about the idea of a husband trying to like drop a hint on his wife about like you need to exercise, he's somehow the face of that, and he is worried that it's going to hurt him getting gigs going forward because all these people are dragging him on Twitter. It should be mentioned, I believe he changed his Instagram handle to Peloton Dad, so you would, that's not exactly running away from the notoriety.
No, this is the thirstiest grab of all thirsty grabs. I find this to be so disingenuous and irritating. He's trying to draft off of this. He's in the commercial, like you said, Veeves and I were kind of analyzing it. He's in the commercial for two shots, each of which is about a second long. Nobody would even recognize him. He's just he's a handsome man, but he's not like some guy who is going to not get a gig in the future because, oh, your face is associated with Peloton or whatever. He is just trying to publicize this. Also, can we talk about Peloton Dad? Does he say that, or is it Peloton Husband? Because there are no children in this ad. Oh, okay. Okay. They're not saying Peloton Dad. Yeah. They're saying Husband.
No,
okay.
That's my fault. I think I said Peloton Dad when I meant Peloton Husband.
Okay. Because I was going to say, like, her being a mom and him being a dad, where is that coming up in a sequel?
Now, let me just say this. Let me offer this one, like, little bit of sort of counter opinion and experience. I'm sure he's super thirsty. I'm sure he's super, like, probably tried out for the Canadian Bachelor, whatever. Like, my guess is even the guy who wrote the article about him in Psychology Today looks like he could be trying out for whatever the Psychology Today version of The Bachelor is. He's like a super conventionally handsome, yoked, certain kind of dude who's writing about probably someone who's his friend. You know, they probably know each other from the Orange Theory gym that they go to in Vancouver. Okay. But I will say this. It is very weird why people get cast or not cast in commercials. And it is like if you're a just kind of generically handsome dude and there are you're trying out for an Avis commercial and there are 8,000 generically handsome dudes. If you are one that has been in a commercial that people were universally not into, it actually could hurt your chances of being cast because if they just have a bunch of headshots spread out and they're like, this guy or this guy, let's not go with the guy who was in the Peloton commercial that everyone was mad about. Now, here's the thing. Your point is also right, Andrew, that he should shut up about it because no one would remember it. No one looking at his face, at his headshot for the next commercial he tries out for, would figure out that he was that guy. But by changing his Twitter handle or his Instagram handle and by talking about it, he is now actually making that happen. Like he is making himself. So if he thinks that he's like he's sort of like leveraging his 15 minutes to get more famous, he's making a grave error, I think, because now people I would have never could have never told you what the dude looks like. And now I can tell you what he looks like.
Yeah, I mean, whatever the realities are in a casting situation, fine. But I stand by my argument that this is a disingenuous argument that he is making. By changing his Twitter handle, by going public like this, I don't know if it ends up hurting him or helping him in the long run, but he is trying to leverage this moment. Which, I mean, you know, maybe I'd be more successful in life if I tried to leverage moments and didn't feel icky about certain things, although I don't know how – I haven't been in any terrible commercials lately, but I don't know. It's just such bullshit. It really upsets me.
I'm gonna say one more thing. I'm not just trying to like wind you up. There was that thing that Carrie and I did years ago for Microsoft that was this whole like kind of misguided attempt at some kind of humor that just ended up on the internet and was not funny. It was just dumb. It was a very surreal thing to see like Fox Business News talking about it and just like it was weird to see a surprisingly large number of people who didn't know anything about what was actually going on with it speculating, and then people on the internet just like roasting us, which was fine. We deserved it, but it was a kind of a surreal feeling. And I do think this guy is probably it's really not about him. I mean, the problem is this isn't about him. This is about the ad, and I guess more primarily the woman who's in the ad. And so I think he's having this moment of like, oh my God, a thing I was kind of tangentially involved in is like one of the biggest conversations happening in pop culture right now. And then I guess your point is what he should do is just zip it and just like ride it out. And if he really wants to just keep being hunky dad number two in the background of an Acura commercial, just low profile it for a minute and then you can continue doing that. He is probably dazzled by this because he's just never been part of a conversation that's just going so far and wide, and he is probably trying to capitalize on it. But I guess all I was trying to say is, to the degree that he did have people tweeting that, like, that dad, like, what kind of an asshole would do that? Sorry to use a swear there. I do kind of know how that is a little weird to have people who don't know you saying stuff online about you. That's a little surreal.
I'm sure it is, but you didn't change your Twitter handle to you know,
Microsoft.
It wasn't
dad.
Tim Cook or Microsoft. Like whatever. Yeah. Or not Tim Cook. Anyway. But the actions that he's taking belie what he's saying. I think he's clearly trying to leverage it. He's leveraging it on Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know, the iconic shot. And again, like I keep saying, not to break it down again, I've done that way too many times with way too many words, but this commercial is cringeworthy for a lot of reasons. It's several specifically, and it's more nuanced than I think some people are giving it credit for. But the face of it, or where it really starts, and the reason Veeves and I like this commercial struck me and Veeves the wrong way immediately, which is why we ended up doing a whole show on it a couple of weeks ago, was that shot of her at the beginning where she's looking into her own camera saying, I'm nervous, and she's making that nervous face. I mean, there's something so tone deaf and cringeworthy about that moment. Then there's some other problems as it goes down. So that is the iconic moment of this commercial. I just do right. not buy. I mean, he might be having some real feelings about this. He's a real person with real feelings. Fine. But to try to get an article, to try to like kind of extend your viral moment by changing your Twitter handle and seeking out media interviews is just those two things fly in each other's face.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think he's probably like kind of geek. Like he's probably kind of kind of excited about the fact that he was involved in something that is getting a lot of attention, even if it's negative attention. He doesn't exactly know what to do about that. And if he was smart, he would just leave it alone, because if his true intention, like, here's what I will say. There's no way that him talking about it to Psychology Today is going to make him more likely to get booked on another thing. You know, it's not like if he thinks he's building a brand, if that's his intention, he's definitely not. He's definitely hurting himself, because he's not somebody, he's not quirky. He's not, you know, he's not Eric Wareheim being playing reality in one of those commercials. Like it's like what he has going for himself is that he's a conventionally handsome person, that he can play a conventionally handsome husband who finds a car with a giant bow on it or what
yeah,
have you.
Right, exactly.
Like, that's what he has to offer as far as what I'm able to observe. And so to that degree, he needs to just, like, be very, like, he needs to continue being interchangeable with other guys like that.
Yeah.
And so to the degree that he's now making it more about him and putting more attention on himself, that's a bad move if he wants to keep getting booked for things.
All right. I know you know about TBTL, the podcast. You're listening to it right now. But have you tried TBTL, the newsletter? Because you can. Just go over to TBTL.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. I got to say, it's a lot of fun. Every week, Luke and I record a little video that we include in the newsletter. It's called Hey Dummies. We answer your questions, any questions you want to ask us. Well, there's all kinds of things in the newsletter. Don't take my word for it. Here, this is Mary. She's a big fan of the newsletter.
It has a nice welcome introduction, but then you have these phenomenal GIFs that are so much fun. You talk about amazing, wonderful people, and you introduce us to new things. And then the songs of the week. Oh, my gosh. And it just makes me so happy.
It can make you happy, too. I mean, listen, this is coming from Mary. She doesn't even listen to the podcast. She's here just for the newsletter. No joke. So, again, go to TBTL.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. And we'll try to bring a little extra sunshine to your inbox every Friday afternoon.
Here I go once again with the email. Every week, I hope that it's from a female. Oh, man, it's not from a female.
All right. Any emails or V-mails before we get out of here? We've got a no point we're going to do, I think, too, if we
yes.
have time today.
We might have to push that off until tomorrow. So if listeners are waiting right. for that in their feed, we may have to do that tomorrow. But we will figure
we
that
actually,
out.
We actually, you know what? Honestly, shows. For Seahawk fans anyway, maybe we need an extra day. just to...
Yeah. Yeah. Here, let me read a couple of fun emails for you, though. Okay. Here's one. We were talking about the TV hacking. There was an article that you found last week that kind of blew us away about the smart TVs and how people are trying to hack into them. And we thought it was kind of funny that, like, you can hack in and change the we thought it'd be funny if you hacked into somebody's TV and just, like, subtly kept changing the volume on people. Right. Sharon.
Deleting episodes of things yeah. that they wanted to watch.
Where's my diagnosis murder? God damn it. Who's part wow. two of a two-parter. Sharon in Texarkana says, OMG, I had completely forgotten about this story, but your talk about taking over someone's TV reminded me. When my husband and I moved into our first house 13 years ago. Did I say first house? First house 13 years ago, we had the bad habit of watching TV at night in the bedroom. One night, we were watching the TV, and it just switched to the guide and started scrolling and then changed channels. We were confused and changed it back. It promptly went back to the previous channel. This happened randomly for several months and then just stopped and hasn't happened again. We never knew why it happened, but... our bedroom is on the side of the house that is closest to the neighbors. But how? Question mark. That could be. I mean, could it be that your bedroom happens to, like, your TV is in a part of your house that is as close to your neighbor's TV remote control setup? And somehow those, what kind of rays? Are they infrared rays that operate, you know, remote controls, are those bouncing in some weird way and getting into your...
It's in The Mandalorian somewhere. Yeah. I haven't got to that episode
Please
yet.
Call it its proper name, The Mandadorian. I don't know why we all say that. I think Kevin, Camaro Kev, was accidentally calling it The Mandadorian. And so he and Genevieve, and now apparently me, because I just love saying things wrong when it comes to the Star Wars universe, they insist upon calling it The Mandadorian.
Nice. I'll do that.
Yeah.
But I would assume... that this is something that must come up a lot, like with people that live in apartment buildings. And I would assume that there's some way that the remote control to your cable box or your TV is there's some specific serial number, there's some code that makes it so that the other person who's separated by maybe mere feet, their remote control can't control yours. But that is a weird thing.
Yeah, no, that is definitely not the case, at least not at like places like Cairo Radio where they have you know, a couple of TVs next to each other with their own,
I guess you're right.
with their own cable boxes.
If you're at a sports bar,
yeah, yeah, you have to be very careful and shield the remote. Otherwise, you're changing all the channels at once.
Yeah, that's interesting. What did they say? What the other person went to and started watching?
No, that's a really good question.
I mean, I'd let that roll out.
Yeah,
let that play out. Let's just see. Maybe they have better taste than you.
Yeah. Oh, well, Red Shoes Diary again, huh?
Sure.
And also, should we just really quickly take this to Dream Court?
Oh, sure.
You look like a dream catcher came to life.
Oh, that right there.
Sorry, I don't know why. At some point during the show, my iTunes just decides to go to sleep, and then I hit play on something, and it takes about 3 seconds to wake up, and it drives me nuts. Anyway, this is from Linda, who says, "Oh, Lordy, I fell asleep listening to the podcast last night." I think she posted this, by the way, in the Dream Talk channel or Dreamcatcher channel of our Slack community, if anybody's interested in that. "Oh, Lordy, I fell asleep listening to the podcast last night, and I had a dream that I was having a baby, and I went to the hospital. Lo and behold, Andrew was the doctor. Scream. He walked into the room and said to me, 'Well, are you ready to have a baby today?'" That's where apparently where the dream ends.
The doctor was an Andrew.
That's a good show title. The doctor was an Andrew. Also, Hunky Dad Number 2 could be a good show title.
What about Hunky Dads Be Trippin'?
I think we got there.
I don't even know if that really makes sense. But what was it? What was that? That was a 30 Rock thing, right?
Yeah, that was one of the
Hunky Grandmas Be Trippin'.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Oh man. All right. I think that's a good note to end the show on.
Okay.
So let's do that. People have been – I want to talk about – well, I'm going to do a little research actually. People have been sending us a video. Like last night on Twitter, there was at least 5 people tweeting this one thing to me, to you, to the TBTL account. And I am of the opinion that it is a Michael Rapaport joke, right?
I'm quite sure it is.
And it's funny to me because
it's
a dub over,
yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a thing that he does now. Mm-hmm. But let me do a little more digging into it because he basically like did another one with this cat in the UK. I think it's a thing where he just excitedly, in a Michael Rapaporian way, sorry, I messed that up the first time. It's the Rapdadorian.
Rapdadorian, yes.
That's it. Sorry. I think he just does this bit, and everybody is sending it to us, but I kept thinking, that's got to be Michael Rapaport, right? So we'll do some investigating, and if it's not, or even if it is, we'll probably play this moose thing tomorrow, because it's still pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so we'll do that and all the rest, and we'll bring you, it sounds like probably, because you had a bunch of other stuff happening today, we'll push the no point to tomorrow, and we'll bring you that as well. So everybody tune in for that as well. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. And please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all.
Power out.